magical powers to try to predict what President Trump and what this administration's intentions, thoughts, and sort of, you know, psychology and logic actually is. But if we look at what has happened so far, it most certainly does not seem as if any of the plans that are being spoken about or suggested actually have the Palestinian population of Gaza's best interests at heart. And that is a terrifying prospect. People still expect to be forcibly displaced once again. People are terrified that they might eventually be pushed out of Gaza altogether.
Arwa Damon, I want to thank you for being with us. Award-winning journalist, former CNN correspondent, founder of Inara, a nonprofit organization that supports children impacted by war. She has been banned from going back to Gaza. I want to encourage people to come out to our February 23rd Democracy Now! 30th anniversary celebration at the historic Riverside Church in New York. Guests will include Angela Davis and Naomi Klein, the Nobel Prize laureate Maria Ressa, Michael Stipe, the jazz legend Wynton Marsalis, the Palestinian poet Masaba Boutoha, Hooray for the Riff Raff, and more. You can go to democracynow.org to get information and tickets. Back to you, Nermeen.
That does it for the show. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman in Los Angeles.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Hello, KBOO supporters. It's tax season. To request a copy of your 2025 tax receipt, email membership at kboo.org or call at 971-801-1381. That's 971-801-1381 for your 2025 tax receipt. Thank you.
Live folk music abounds, evenings in Portland, but where can you go to hear good folk music to start your day? The answer is right here on KBOO. KBOO's early morning folk strip volunteers give you 90 minutes of a variety of folk music every weekday morning from 5:30 until 7. Just another public service from KBOO Community Radio. Thanks for listening.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, unemployed Oregonians outnumber job openings 2-1.
The Gresham family taken by ICE at a Portland hospital return home.
And a new-look documentary shows librarians confronting book bans.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 9th, 2026. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Dave Johnson. Oregon's unemployment rates is the highest it's been since 2016. The Oregonian reports that there are 2.4 unemployed people for every open job in the state. Oregon's unemployment rate remains one of the highest in the country. The national unemployment rate was 4.4% in December. Oregon's is 5.2%. Some areas are faring worse than others. Josephine County in Southern Oregon, their unemployment rate is 7.2%, according to KOBI News. A loss of manufacturing and retail jobs in Oregon contributed to growing unemployment. Intel, one of Oregon's largest manufacturing employers, cut over 3,000 positions last year. There are some positive signs in the labor market, however. The healthcare sector added 13,000 jobs in 2025 and still has open vacancies. The state's unemployment rate has also remained steady for the past 4 months. Northwest Labor Press reports that a subsidiary to the Australian company Jindalee Resources committed to working with union labor to build a lithium mine in southern Oregon. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management approved an exploration project to develop the mine last December. If built, the mine would employ 1,000 construction workers to build. The mine could account for 600 permanent jobs for at least 63 years. For now, the company is only exploring the potential for building a mine in the future. The mine project faces criticism for harming a protected environment for the sage grouse. OPB reports that the population of the local bird has declined by 80% since the 1960s. A conservation group local to the area argues that there are less harmful methods for accessing lithium.
The Gresham family, who was taken by Border Patrol outside of Adventist Hospital, are home after 22 days in ICE detention. The Crespo Gonzalez family was taking their 7-year-old daughter Diana to the ER when she had a nosebleed that wouldn't stop. Border Patrol agents took the whole family in the parking lot on January 16th before they could get care. Oregon Representative Maxine Dexter traveled to the Texas Detention Center where they were held to escort them home. The Department of Homeland Security claims the family entered the U.S. illegally in 2024. They used a Customs and Border Patrol app set up by the Biden administration to seek asylum. The Trump administration discontinued the app in January of last year. Anna Lunares is a friend of the family and spoke about her joy at their return home. Lunares said, quote, "It was a relief because it made me realize that everything we'd done had been worth it. All of the hours, reaching out, the fear of speaking with media, when the federal agents got to them, it was horrible. I felt guilty and worried because that exact same place I take my mother-in-law and my kids to get medical care," end quote. Dexter also celebrated their release. She said, quote, "I'm filled with joy that our Oregon family is coming home, yet outraged for many other children and families who remained imprisoned by our government. Detention of children and families is immoral. End family detention. Defund and dismantle ICE. That is the moral path forward," end quote.
Oregon's top state, city, and county leaders push forward their bid to keep the Portland Trailblazers in the Moda Center. Senate President Rob Wagner introduced Senate Bill 1501 that would take income tax paid by construction firms physically doing the renovation to help fund the work, along with taxes paid by the entertainers and sports players who make money when they participate in events at the Moda Center. Wagner and other state and local leaders issued a statement of support of the Oregon Arena, saying, quote, "The city of Portland, state of Oregon, and Multnomah County are fully aligned on the need to act now to modernize Moda Center and secure the Blazers' long-term future here," end quote. The bill is the first look at a local effort to keep the Trailblazers in Portland as the team gets ready to transfer ownership to new owner Tom Dundon. Dundon could move the team to a new city if funding isn't secured to renovate the aging Moda Center. Senate Bill 1501 could siphon income taxes paid by the Blazers and other employers in Portland's Rose Quarter. It's not clear just how much money SB 1501 could divert from Oregon's general fund at a time when the state plans to cut services. New Blazers owner Dundon and his ownership group have not mentioned how much they're willing to chip in for the work either. However, influential Democrats say they believe the trade-off is worth it. Governor Tina Kotek said, quote, "What I think is important is to make sure that we have a facility like Moda Center in Portland that can keep our most important tenant, which is the Trailblazers." She went on to say, "We're in a transition with a new owner, and it's an opportunity for the city and the state and the county to put their best foot forward and say, look, we want to be a partner with the new owner to keep the team," end quote.
The Washington State Senate voted to ban face coverings for law enforcement at the end of January. Senate Bill 5855 applies to local, state, and federal law enforcement. The legislation would allow people detained by masked officers to sue. It also provides exemptions for personal protective wear, among other situations. The bill passed in Senate 30-19. No Republicans supported the bill. Speaking on the Senate floor, bill sponsor, Senator Javier Valdez, said this is not what public safety looks like in a democracy. This is what happens when accountability disappears and fear is allowed to take its place. He also said, quote, "These masked federal agents are operating without accountability." The bill is currently in House Committee for Community Safety. It needs to be approved on the House floor and be signed by the governor in order to become law. OPB reports that Washington Governor Bob Ferguson previously expressed support of the bill.
Whether you want to save money, feel better, or make smarter choices, experts say understanding your health care coverage is key. And yet, research shows 25% of people do not. Washington experts offer some easy ways to maximize your coverage and save on health care costs. Isabel Charlet has more.
With healthcare premiums for many Washingtonians jumping an average of 21%, experts say understanding your health insurance coverage is key to getting the most out of it. Research shows 1 in 4 people knows little about their own health plan, a gap that can cost both money and well-being. Aaron Vantile with the Washington State Office of the Insurance Commissioner says there isn't a magic bullet, but taking advantage of preventative care can save money down the road. He says Washington law mandates that many health benefits be free for enrollees.
There's a lot of screenings you can get: blood pressure screening, cholesterol screening, depression screening, diabetes screening, diet counseling, STI prevention counseling, and a lot more.
He adds treatments for cancer, diabetes, hearing aids, and comprehensive women's health services are also required to be covered. And many immunizations are available at no cost. He says people can look online at insurance.wa.gov for a full list. Healthcare is complex, but Amy Jordan with United Healthcare says insurers are improving their digital tools to help users navigate healthcare systems. She advises users to make sure to download their health plans app if they have one, but don't wait until you need care.
Try to go in, explore, understand a little bit ahead of time, and know that when it comes time to making a decision, you have a great tool and resource there to ensure that you're making the best decision possible for you or your family.
She adds starting by understanding your health plan structure, including your premium, deductible, and out-of-pocket maximum, will help you estimate yearly costs. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Virginia elections signal a potential wave of women as new lawmakers. In Michigan, abortion providers warn of a bill in Congress that would restrict protests at clinic entrances. With that story and more, it's Simone Perez with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
After Donald Trump was elected, we saw a big mobilization of women running for office in Virginia. We saw women who even ran as challengers to incumbents who unseated incumbents at a very high rate.
Debbie Walsh with the Center for American Women in Politics says in the midterms, President Donald Trump has again energized the wave of women to run for office. Virginia saw a surge of women in the state legislature since Trump entered politics. A Democrat has easily retained a state House seat in a Louisiana district that Trump took by more than 10 points. The win in the Plaquemine area is the latest in a series of special election victories for the party. In a highly contested New York City congressional district, former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is endorsing Jack Schlossberg, the grandson of President John Kennedy. Schlossberg has made a name for himself as a savvy social media personality, but faces a crowded primary. Maryland's Democratic Governor Wes Moore is calling on the state Senate to pass his proposed mid-cycle redistricting bill. State House Democrats have favored the move, but under the leadership of the Senate president, that chamber has been resistant. The state could be one of the last to act in a nationwide gerrymandering arms race before November's election. Republicans in Congress may legislate to overrule state laws protecting patients' safe access to abortion clinics, arguing they're being weaponized against the pro-life movement. Renee Chilian with Northland Family Planning says Michigan acted to protect them in the 1990s in response to dangerous and aggressive protesters. She says the clinics won't stop, but anti-abortion activists won't either.
Michigan is one of the safest states for abortion rights in the country, but if the clinics can't keep our doors open, can't protect ourselves, how will we keep staff? How will we keep doctors? That's their goal, is to intimidate and harass everyone.
Washington Post publisher Will Lewis resigned over the weekend, closing a tumultuous tenure that included laying off hundreds of staff and scrapping an endorsement of Vice President Kamala Harris. Recently, the Post has lost thousands of subscribers, angry about the paper's new direction. After resignations over the handling of the ICE shootings in Minneapolis and other issues, the Department of Justice is taking the unusual step of publicly trying to recruit U.S. attorneys. The department is reportedly struggling to keep enough federal prosecutors. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for an in-depth look at autonomous vehicles and the conflicting ways city and state leaders may try to regulate them. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow, look for partly sunny skies with a high of about 55. Today in history, in 1986, Halley's Comet last appeared in the inner solar system. Halley is the only short-period comet visible to the naked eye from Earth. It passes by every 75 to 79 years, so its next appearance will be in mid-2061. The quote of the day is from American singer-songwriter Carole King. Born this day in 1942, she said, quote, "My life has been a tapestry of rich and royal hue, an everlasting vision of the ever-changing view, a wondrous woven magic in bits of blue and gold, a tapestry to feel and see, impossible to hold."
Lawmakers in New Mexico plan a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to study the history of the forced sterilization of Native women in the state. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. For decades, Native women and other women of color were subjected to forced sterilization by the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Indian Health Service. Last week, New Mexico lawmakers introduced a memorial to create a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that would conduct a study into the history and continuing impacts of this abuse. KUNM's Jeanette DeDios reports.
Senate Memorial 14 includes research dating to the 1970s, which shows between 25 and 50% of indigenous women were sterilized, with some of the highest incidents occurring in New Mexico. The memorial would develop a plan to create a state Truth and Reconciliation Commission to research and find all cases of sterilization in the state, gather survivor testimony, and review and recommend educational policy. Keely Badger is a human rights advocate who wrote her dissertation on the forced sterilization of Native women. Lawmakers asked her about challenges finding and accessing records.
I do think that the requests have to come from an official state body, official agencies, to get to the heart of this information. It is going to be more than one person's ability to accumulate this information.
She says this may have been intentional by the states.
At a national level, they have sealed some of these records for a reason. In the same way that a lot of the information about the boarding school system was very, very challenging, took decades and decades of research to accumulate to get to a point where we could have a national apology. I believe that this is one of those situations where it's going to require real political will and advocacy from civil society groups to get to the real heart of this from a national perspective.
If the memorial goes into law, New Mexico would be the first state in the nation to formally investigate and acknowledge these violations. The memorial will head to the Senate floor for a vote, and if passed, will go to the House of Representatives.
For National Native News, I'm Jeanette DeDios.
Last week, thousands of members from the White Mountain Apache tribe went to the polls to vote in a primary election that resulted in the sitting chairman losing his chance at another term. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports.
In a three-way race, Chairman Casey Velasquez earned a little over 400 votes, while his challengers both received nearly four times as much, according to the tribe's election commission. In the end, though, longtime White River School Board member Orlando Carroll got the most votes by a margin of more than 50 ballots. He will face off against Councilman Gary Alchesay in the April general election. Also on Wednesday, the tribe announced that a special prosecutor declined to criminally charge Velasquez under tribal law for allegations of sexual harassment against the HR director. A civil investigation by the tribe is still ongoing. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
The Seahawks, Super Bowl champions for the second time.
And you'll be seeing lots of commemorative Seahawks swag now that Seattle's NFL team has won Super Bowl 60. The Hawks beat the New England Patriots 29-13. The BBC reports that many Native American and First Nations people appreciate the team's logo. Turns out that it's based on a carved transformation mask from the Quaqua-Kewak Nation from the late 1800s. The logo is chosen by the Seahawks manager in the 1970s. Seattle's Burke Museum traced the origins of it to a photo of a ceremonial mask in an old art book. This led them to the Hudson Museum in Maine. The mask was loaned to Seattle for a ceremony of tribal members and team representatives. The BBC reports that unlike other major league sports teams, the Seahawks logo hasn't sparked backlash because it respectfully borrows from indigenous culture and doesn't resort to racist stereotypes. In fact, some indigenous people from Canada and the U.S. say it's inspired them to learn more of their own culture. A ceremony and parade for the Seahawks will be held in Seattle Wednesday morning. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
A new report from a coalition of researchers and advocacy groups details widespread environmental hazards and human rights abuses at the Glades County Detention Center in Moorhaven, Florida. The facility, which housed immigrants in ICE custody between 2008 and 2022, is accused of exposing detainees to toxic chemicals, pepper spray misuse, and preventable carbon monoxide poisoning. Tramell Gomes reports.
A new report alleges the Glades County Detention Center exposed detained immigrants to toxic chemicals, pepper spray punishment, and hazardous air, causing lasting health harm. The report, published by a coalition of immigrant rights and environmental organizations, calls the facility a site of environmental violence. Guadalupe De La Cruz with the American Friends Service Committee says the findings reflect a broader pattern in immigration detention.
We see that it is a common practice for detention facilities to either be opened on contaminated land or have such harsh conditions that the health of people that are in the facility runs a major risk.
The report details that during the COVID-19 pandemic, toxic disinfectant sprays were overused and pepper spray was deployed as punishment. In 2021, a carbon monoxide leak hospitalized several detained workers and staff. The Glades County Sheriff's Office did not respond to a request for comment on the report's allegations by deadline. De La Cruz argues that facilities like Glades profit from human suffering and do not benefit the local communities they promise to help.
I think it's very important for people to understand that no corporation, no company, no facility should be profiting over the hardship of individuals, and that people have a right to choose where they choose to settle.
The report calls on state and local leaders to end participation in immigration detention and permanently close the Glades facility. Free copies of the full report are available online through the American Friends Service Committee. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
This February, American History Month, brings a life-saving reminder to Oregonians. You don't need to be a medical professional to save a life. Experts stress that basic knowledge and courage and willingness to perform CPR are what matter. Isabel Charlet speaks with one Oregonian who shares her recent experience saving her husband's life with CPR.
February is American Heart Month, and experts are reminding people that you don't need medical credentials to save someone's life. All you need is some basic knowledge and the courage and willingness to perform CPR. More than 70% of out-of-hospital cardiac arrests occur in homes, and the person's survival depends on immediate action. Tia Sherry of Portland learned this lesson last fall after her husband, Dave Gettler, collapsed with no warning while on a bike ride.
Whether you're CPR certified or not, you are the first responder until
help arrives. You never think you're going to use it, especially with your loved one. And I'm so glad that I stayed on top of my certification because it kept Dave alive.
Sherry says after a quadruple bypass surgery and many months of cardio rehab, Dave is doing much better and is back on his bike. Research shows that CPR, when performed immediately, can triple a cardiac arrest victim's chance of survival. However, bystanders step in to help with CPR only about 40% of the time, and women and Black adults are less likely to receive CPR than others. Sherry encourages everyone to at least learn the basics so you can be confident when you need to.
For those that are concerned or worried or think that they don't know how to do CPR, what are the options? That somebody die with you because you didn't try?
People can learn hands-only CPR through an online video offered by the American Heart Association or visit heart.org/nation to find a local CPR class. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
A legacy Black-owned newspaper in Portland ceased operation last month. The Scanner served Portland for over 50 years. Co-founder and executive director Bobby Dorr Foster told Willamette Week, quote, "We closed the business due to changing technology. We face the same issues that have plagued newspapers for the last decade. Advertisers have migrated to social media platforms." Bernie Foster and Bobby Dorr Foster founded the newspaper in 1975. Dorr Foster told KGW News, quote, "This means our community will no longer be informed about news from an African-American perspective that affects them individually and collectively," end quote. Journalist Donovan Scribes reported for the Scanner before the pandemic. He told KGW that the newspaper's reporting dug deeper into stories. He said, quote, "When I was doing a story, it was really like I was doing a story like this thing happened. It was more like this thing happened and here are the things that powered us to this moment," end quote. The Scanner stopped their print publication in 2020.
Breezy Johnson became the first American in 16 years to win the Olympic downhill skiing medal. Johnson won in 1 minute 36.10 seconds, with Germany's Emma Eicher just 0.4 seconds slower in winning silver. This marked the Americans' first medal of the Games in any sport. Johnson, 30 years old, has now won the biggest downhill races of the past year, after being atop the podium the 2025 World Championships. That last American Olympic downhill gold medalist was Lindsey Vonn, who crashed badly 13 seconds into her run during these Games. Vonn ruptured her ACL 9 days ago. Johnson said, quote, "Lindsey has accomplished so much. We live in different echelon than I do. But I think that to have your name alongside her is really something special," end quote. Johnson started sixth and laid down a run more than a second faster than any of the five previous skiers. Johnson is known as one of the sport's best gliders, and the Olympic run's lower sections are well suited to those utilizing that style. Johnson is an Idaho native who learned to ski in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. She was skiing in her second Olympic Games. She also qualified for a third in 2022, but was injured. Johnson is set to race again Tuesday in the combined event.
The effort by religious or right-wing groups to ban books in the United States has spiked in recent years, and a new documentary sheds light on the issue. The Librarians debuts on PBS tonight. The film follows librarians on the front lines of the book banning movement. Suzanne Potter spoke with the director to learn more.
In many states, librarians bear the brunt of anger from people on both sides of book banning, and a new documentary highlights the emotional toll. The organization PEN America, which advocates for freedom of expression, says the number of book bans in the past 4 years is unprecedented, with more titles being removed from libraries across the country. Filmmaker Kim Schneider highlights the surge in her documentary, The Librarians. Schneider traveled to Texas, Florida, and New Jersey in 2021 and 2022 to chronicle how librarians have become frontline workers in the national debate over book bans.
We have experienced many librarians who come and see it, who feel encouraged and motivated by the stories of the other librarians to be able to speak their story and how important it is.
Several librarians who appear in the film lost their jobs after refusing to remove books, especially those that contained LGBTQ or race-related content. Others resigned after continued threats and harassment. Lawmakers in at least 15 states are considering bills that would restrict access to literature in school or public libraries. Schneider says librarians are not people who have a lot of power or money, but many are rich in courage.
These people have a lot to lose, and they are not standing down. I just hope that people take their cue and are inspired to do what you can, and as I say, like sweeping your own little corner to help protect our fragile democracy right now.
The documentary premiered at the 2025 Sundance Film Festival and has since toured the country to sold-out audiences. Schneider says that's a big deal for a small-budget film with limited funds for publicity.
It just doesn't happen often of 200 theaters and repeat demands for returns in the heartland, a lot in the heartland of those requests.
Iowa, Florida, and Texas consistently have the most book bans. The documentary will be shown tonight on PBS. Support for this reporting was provided by the philanthropic foundation Carnegie Corporation of New York. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News from Monday, February 9th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Anna Wilcox, and Dave Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Nick Caperso. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Zamon Perez, Antonia Gonzalez, Tramel Gomez, Suzanne Potter, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We're digging into autonomous vehicles.